Right, so I hope in this talk to introduce an unparticle solution to the Planck-Weak hierarchy problem. So maybe unparticles have a purpose after all, other than their striking signatures. And this is work that I did with Tony Gargetta at the University of Melbourne. Okay. So the outline here, I'll give a brief or maybe not so brief introduction, then talk about a particular solution to Einstein's equations, which is the Battelle-Gargetta softwall. Then after going through that, talk about actually getting the hierarchy with this background. And that's where we'll see the unparticles come in. Then talk about the fluctuations about this background. And if I have time, then I'll just discuss putting some bulk fields in this geometry. All right, so we can dive right in. We all know about the Planck-Weak hierarchy problem. The Higgs boson is sensitive to the highest scale of new physics. If you just look at the quadratic corrections, the mass corrections, of course, they go with the highest scale of the new physics in your problem. And if only the standard model is assumed, and the new physics is going to be when gravity becomes strong, which, of course, is the Planck scale. And so you then need a way to separate this 10 to the 19 GeV with the weak scale, which is around a TeV. And Randall and Sundrum told us a way to do that with warped extra dimensions. And this works by, the typical RS1 scenario where you have an UV brain and an IR brain, and then you have this metric which gives you a warping. And if you look at that, then if you start out with a short distance at this end, it gets warped up to a large distance at this end, or alternatively, high mass scales at this end get warped down to low mass scales at this end. So you then solve your separation, because the Planck scale, even though it's large here, gets warped down and locally small. It's around a TeV. All right. But then that wasn't the only thing that Randall and Sundrum told us about. They also gave us another RS2 scenario, where they send the IR brain away to infinity. This won't solve your hierarchy problem, but it has a nice feature in that you can actually have an infinite extra dimension, so you're no longer compact. And they showed that if you do this, there is a single massless tensor mode, which is the graviton, so you still have gravity. And then there's a continuum of tensor modes that start just above epsilon close to zero and carry on. And they looked at the corrections to that, and you wouldn't have discovered them yet, to the gravitational force law. And then if you put bulk fields in this geometry, they'll also have a continuum of modes, just like the continuum of tensors there. And so then a question that I'd like to address is, what is the meaning of these continuum of modes? For example, when you put the bulk fields here.
Is it non-compact in finite volume?
Yes. Okay. So then, to determine what the meaning of these continuum of modes is, I will ask a different question and then come back to this. So the question that I'll first ask is, what is an unparticle? And Georgi originally proposed that an unparticle is an operator in your theory that's non-trivially scale invariant. And if you force this operator to have a scale invariant, it's going to fix the propagator to be of a particular form. And then he had a resulting interpretation of this unparticle as a fractional number of massless particles. And it was a fractional number of massless particles because he chose this non-trivial scale invariance. And it usually was a fractional number. The scaling dimension was a fraction. So then that is the thing that gave you this behavior as a fractional number of massless particles. So that's how Georgi defined a nonparticle. But scale invariance is, of course, just a subset of conformal invariance. So you can really just modify this, if you would like, to an operator that is conformally invariant. And then if you do that, you then get to see that you have to restrict your scaling dimension between 1 and 2. This lower bound comes from a unitarity constraint. Your theory won't be unitary if it's not greater than 1. And this upper bound comes because you want to restrict yourself from being sensitive to UV physics. Your propagator will go like the inverse of m squared to the 2 minus d, so if d becomes bigger than 2, then it goes into the numerator and you have problems with sensitivity to UV physics. But the unparticles are going to need to couple to the standard model if we're going to see them in any detectors. So if we want them to, so we're going to need them to couple to the standard model. But of course, the Higgs-VEV at least breaks the conformal invariance because it's a mass scale. And it does it at low scales. Yeah, I should have emphasized here, he wants not it to be non-trivially scale invariant at low scales in the TEV region. But at high scales, it can be non-scale invariant, but it's going to run down to be a scale invariant theory at low scales. But if you're restricted to this scaling dimension between 1 and 2, your operator here, this unparticle operator, can couple to the Higgs with a relevant coupling. Georgi, when he introduced those, was only considering irrelevant operator coupling, so they're all suppressed. But this with this dimension, you can actually get a relevant coupling to the Higgs. So then, when the Higgs vacuum expectation value, which of course you need to break electroweak symmetry, breaks the conformal invariance, it will transmit that through its coupling to the unparticle and break the unparticle's, this operator's, conformal invariance. And that was showed by Fox, Rajaraman, and Sherman that this would happen. So then if that happens, you're left with the question on how you're going to define an unparticle, because you wanted to define it to be conformally invariant or scale invariant at low scales, but then you broke it. Anyway, so now you need to have an interpretation of what an unparticle is if you can't define it that way. The answer to how you may define it if you are breaking the conformal invariance at low scales was hinted at by Stefanov, who gave an interpretation of an unparticle as an infinite tower of massive modes with small mass spacing. So he would put this in the context of a 5D extra dimension, and then you would see your KK tower if you adjusted the spacing so that it was small, and in fact take the limit as it goes to zero. That's what he would say you can interpret an unparticle as. And he did consider the limit where the mass spacing went to zero, but he was still considering just scaling dimension between 1 and 2. And then Falkovsky and Perez-Victoria came along and made this statement more precise. And of course, since the conformal symmetry is broken at low scales anyway, we can use the ADS-CFT picture, the ADS-CFT correspondence, to give a 5D picture, just like Stefanov was doing. But when you have the full 5D picture, you can actually just evaluate the 5D propagator. And if you consider the full 5D propagator, and you look at having the mass spacing go to zero, you can recover the limit on the scaling dimension in a particular, when you take a limit of it, but this gives a general result in that you're not restricted. Well, you're not restricted with the number bound. You still have the lower bound. It has to be greater than 1. But you can have an operator of any scaling dimension larger than 1. When you just consider the full 5D propagator. So then, what you can really interpret as an unparticle, if you're using this 5D picture, is anything where you have a continuous spectrum of excitations. If you really want to retain as close as you can to George Rye's original definition, you would insist that it has some sort of fractional scaling dimensions. It looks like a fractional number of massless particles. But otherwise, we can use this definition. Then, if this is going to be our definition of unparticles, you have to ask, how can I break the conformal symmetry at low scales in the 5D picture? And one way you can break the conformal symmetry in the 5D picture, well, maybe I should back up a little bit and say with just, well, actually, let's do it this way. We can do it by abruptly ending space at pi r, like the RS1 scenario it is. And so then you, if you look at it, you start in ADS, and then you can run down, and then you break the conformal symmetry when you hit this IR brain. Or pictorially, you're walking along, and then you hit a hard wall. Now, another way, so that was RS1, and then RS2, when you take R to infinity, you don't have any wall anymore, so you can just walk right through, and that would correspond to actually not breaking the conformal symmetry at all in the low scale, which is then corresponding to what Georgi was really looking at when he was considering an unparticle, because it had exact conformal invariance at that scale. But so I have the two extremes here, one where I have no wall, no conformal symmetry breaking, and one where I break it as hard as possible, because I had a hard wall. And then the question is there anything in between? And there is, and it's the soft wall, represented here by a padded room. Okay. So I want to talk about a particular soft wall. And this is the one that was introduced by Patel and Gergetta. When they were considering this, at least initially, they were concerned about ADS QCD. And what they wanted, they wanted to realize what a previous paper had suggested could be a solution. And that what they wanted was a dynamical solution to Einstein's equations. And they wanted it to have, in this theory, a real scalar, which would be associated with the string theory dilaton, that had a power law of vacuum expectation value, that the background involved the scalar, and it had a power law. In addition to that, if they really wanted to associate this with a dilaton, it needed to be, they wanted it to be conformally equivalent to a pure anti-de Sitter space in the string frame. So if you're in an Einstein frame, you can do a conformal transformation, and you'll get an anti-de Sitter metric, and you'll get the standard dilaton coupling that was the goal. And then what they found was that to do this required two real scalar fields. One of them, this phi field, would be associated with the dilaton, and then the other one, called T, would be another string theory scalar tachyon. Right. And these are then the background solutions.
I can understand the constraint. I mean, can you go back to the slide?
Sure.
So the problem you're trying to solve is you want to make a formal to pure ADS in the string frame.
That's right.
So why can't I just take this ADS and just do a conformal transformation and get anything? Just take some arbitrary scalar configuration. So somehow the dynamic solution to Einstein's equations must be what limits the freedom of what you do.
Well, you can take ADS and do a conformal transformation on it, but you're not guaranteed to get a dilaton then that has the power law vacuum expectation value. So the other constraint that's...
Can I just assume that the scalar that I'm doing the conformal transformation by is a power law?
If you do that, then it will back react on your geometry, and you don't know how it's necessarily going to back react on your geometry. So you could deviate from ADS. The Einstein equations, would be the difficulty. All right. So then, using the line element here, and I'll use it in the conformal coordinate z, or z, depending on your preference. The metric factor, then, is in the Einstein frame is given by this. And so you have your ADS space piece here, and then here's the contribution of the scalars. They back react on your metric and give you that. And then if you consider this theory, you'll see that the scalar that you're associating with the dilaton has this vacuum expectation value, which is a power law in the z coordinate. And
some of the hard thing must be the action, right? If you allow me to make up any action I want, I can always satisfy the field equations, can I?
You're the action.
I well, not for the two scalar field case,
true.
But
the action's complicated.
So why do you need the second? My real question was why do you need t? Why couldn't I just do everything with phi? Just do a conformal transformation. I get something, and I make up a set of equations that it's the solution to. So there's something in your setup that I don't see yet.
Yeah, we couldn't find a solution like that. Just one scalar field.
There's no action. Yeah. The trivia you get, there's no action.
I don't think we have a proof, but we couldn't find this. We
think,
find a solution like that.
I think I can make an argument, sort of. You'll need... So in order to be conformally equivalent to ADS space, you'll need the dilaton to absorb... This. Basically, you'll need log kz plus the vev of the dilaton. I mean, you can see it's right here. There's a factor that's different. But this is really log of kz and the vev of the dilaton. And you'll need that form because you'll need to do the transformation. It'll have to be some e to the some number times phi to get that. And that will give you the actual string theory coupling of the dilaton. So you're fixed in the transformation that you need to make to get... back to ADS in the string frame. And so if you do that, and then you... So you can write this generally then if you want as the log of kz plus some arbitrary function. And then, yes, there'll be a class of theories with an arbitrary function there, but with just one scalar field... The Einstein's equations will tell you exactly what this has to be, and the issue that he was having is to be able to integrate that system. It's not trivial to be able to solve those equations with just one scalar.
Another way to think of it is that you know that pure ADS is just a cosmological constant. So now I want to also add a scalar with some energy momentum. So that's going to back react on the metric. And so, basically, what you have to do is add another scalar, which has a profile in such a way that it cancels off that contribution, so as to leave pure ADS.
Okay.
So it doesn't back react. So that the metric isn't back react. So that's essentially why we use two fields.
Is part of the rules that in the Einstein frame the metric has to be considered?
No.
In the string frame. So if you do what he was saying, just in the string frame. And you give the dilaton of Ev, it will change your space.
So the way you described it, I would worry that it's fine-tuned with one of these scales against another. There's no issues.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I'm not saying it's not fine-tuned. It's a very special action that does this.
Yeah. Somehow it sounds like you're saying there's two. So if I just take Einstein space and I take the profile for phi and I go to the Einstein frame and I just look at what the scale see where the curvature is, or where the eyesight tensor is. And I say the right-hand side has to be T mu for some matter action. And I take the equation and I ask, you're saying the problem is I can't, if I call that my matter action, I don't know that the phi equation is emotionally satisfied. I'm just trying to see where I get something which is going to force me to an obstruction to finding an action. If you give me some profile.
Well, the obstruction is, can you solve Einstein's equations afterwards?
Well, the thing is, if you don't tell me the action is, I can always make up an action so that I'll call that action, whatever it is, I have to be to solve. Those are the equations I had to solve to get what you gave me the solution. And I'm trying to see what stops me from doing that. And it sounds like you're saying it's overdetermined somehow.
I don't know that the statement is necessarily that it's overdetermined. As Brian pointed out, there isn't a proof that you need to fields to do this. It's just that no one's found one.
The fact people that there's doubt makes it sound like if I just, because what I'm describing is a stupid thing, right? It's just, you give me a profile, and I define the right-hand side of the Einstein, I think G mu is equal to something, that's T mu, I'd say, what was that DD G mu of, and that would be my action. And
right.
The check would have to be that somehow the phi equation is being satisfied by that action vector phi, would I have got this solution somehow.
I mean, that's okay. Essentially the technique we use, but with two fields, and I think with one field that we weren't able to do that inversion to actually find the action. So you're saying, there's some action that would give me this, but we couldn't actually find.
Well, the property of the action you are not telling us. That's why he is asking about. What is the requirement from the action that it does? If you make it, what's your wish list? What is it supposed to do?
To satisfy the equations of motion.
Well, which equations of motion?
The scalar field and the gravitational.
Well, what do you engineer the action to do?
That's what's hard to do, is engineering the action with just one scalar.
Well, why is it hard to engineer it if there's one scalar and with a given...
Well, so let's say you took this particular geometry, for example, and then when you do that, and I'll show you the answer for that particular geometry, you won't get this behavior anymore.
I think the key is the soft wall, right? Because if you could go back to RS, put a scalar field in, try to stabilize with that, but then you have to put a boundary tension. So if you don't have a tension, if you don't have a boundary, then you need something else to fix it up. I mean, I think if you just put a bulk scalar field in and you look at the dynamics of what the space time will do, it's not good. You won't be able to satisfy, I think.
If you put a massless bulk scalar field, I know that it ends in the singularity. the exponent becomes a hyperbolic sign. This I know. But, maybe the question Cliff was asking, can you sort of put that crazy intricate
thing? You're assuming that it's a reasonable theory, isn't it?
Right.
the theory that we wrote down was like that, but we just couldn't find an analytic solution with one scalar field. So
because you wanted to have an explicit expression for the action, would you have been happy just to know that it existed? Was it important to know what the action was?
I mean, it was just important we were trying to find a system which gave the solution.
Yeah. But besides metric, there is a statement about the
scalar field.
The scalar field. You also want
a particular behavior for the scalar
field. Yes, you want it to be a power law. Yeah.
Well, that's it then.
Then you cannot do it with one. I can imagine that there are situations where you cannot do it with one field.
I guess that's right.
Is this something beyond case is like?
I mean, it's I don't know how to say that, but I would say that this we have an explicit action which satisfies the equation. I mean, satisfies an extreme of conditions.
Yeah. In other words, if you eliminate line 3, right?
This one, you can do it.
Phi would have a different behavior.
Oh, yeah.
Well, in fact, I'll show you what the one field solution is, because my interest will be in solving the Planck-Weak hierarchy and using
two. The string frame, and then you're saying I have to have some profile and then it's a space as a solution. And
yeah.
Spaces, and then I want to be a solution for it.
All right. So so then this is the solution. I haven't put down the potential here, but they give it in their paper. And so the dilaton then goes, of course, with the power law that they want. And then there's this extra field. And it also actually goes as a power law, but it's just the square root of that one. All right. So then just to get a picture of what this soft wall is really doing, I've plotted here this metric factor as a function of mu z. And then you can see in this well, I don't even know what color you're seeing this as. It's purple-ish on my computer, but but whatever color you want to call this, you can see, I've plotted the log of kz here, that in this region, where z is less than 1 over mu, it looks pretty much just like the anti-de Sitter space portion. And then in this region here, which is another interesting color, it deviates then significantly from the ADS space. So then this is really, this is parameterizing when the back reaction becomes significant on our metric, or on the metric, the ADS space there. So that's the sense that it's a soft wall. I have this on the next slide. Because then you can actually vary between the RS1 case and the RS2 case. If you take this new parameter to go to infinity, then of course for mu z less than 1, that just goes to 0, and you're just left with mu z less than 1 to the infinity, that will be 0, and so you're just left with this log piece, which is then the anti-de Sitter space. And then for mu z greater than 1, you have a number larger than 1 to the infinity, which is just going to be infinity. So you really run into your hard wall scenario. Your space ends at this 1 over mu when you hit 1 over mu there. And then you can actually reproduce the RS2 case where you have no wall at all. When you take nu goes to 0, then you'll just have this as well, because anything to the 0 power, well, it's 1, so there is technically a constant here, but you can just reabsorb it into there, and you'll get back just pure ADS space. So then this then is soft in the sense that you can go from no wall to a hard wall. So.
I think I just one quick question.
Sure.
All this engineering being done to get the soft wall, I think I just don't know part of the intellectual history here. Is it that you knew if some people knew if they got a soft wall that they would have a better holographic description of QCD? Is that the idea?
Yes, so the hard wall gives you the n squared mass spacing, and QCD tells you, if you look at the meson mass spacing, it doesn't go like n squared, it goes like n.
Yeah.
So if you want to reproduce that n behavior, you can't have the hard wall, because that will go like n squared. You need something that will sort of slowly, so you can adjust to make it give you the n, and that's the soft wall.
That's why you have the
mission. Yes, well, that was the original,
okay.
Yeah, to reproduce that. So then this, from this, where you see that you can continuously vary between, you can see that mu is setting your IR scale, because it's sort of giving you the location of your IR brain in the RS1 case. So this is really the thing that's telling you where your IR is. I mean, it's also the spot where you significantly deviate from ADS. So in some sense, you can see it in that too. All right.
Just one question related to what you said.
Sure.
They knew the power law dependence, or was this just intuition that they knew they got power law dependence?
Oh, there was a paper.
Because it seems like until you knew the get when you're also as an inspection?
There was
an intuition?
No, there was a paper beforehand that discussed, I forget the authors at the moment, but they discussed what the solution to get the linear, the end behavior would be. But all they said was that this is the sort of behavior that you would need, is a power law type behavior. But they didn't have a dynamical solution. And so then, but Battelle and Jurgetta came and actually gave you one.
But basically, it's just like if you think about a Schrodinger equation, you have, you know, infinite square well or harmonic oscillator potential. And those are the two different behaviors, n squared versus n.
Okay, so yeah, that's, yeah.
Who's this Battelle guy?
Yeah, he's... Well, you can, you know, go to the archive, look them up, and see. All right, so then what I would like to do is get a Planck-weak hierarchy solution. That is, in other words, since mu is telling me my IR scale, I'd like to get mu over k to be around 10 to the minus 16, so then mu is around a TeV. And I'd like to achieve this naturally, if possible. But... what I'd like to note here is I can simplify my life because the solution, of course, only depends on the mu, which was already in the geometry of my theory. It was the mu z to the nu in the metric factor. So, and it's not dependent on the particular dilettante profile that we were using. So if I'm willing to give up this power law behavior of the dilettante, which, since it's not important for solving the Planck-weak hierarchy, I can do, I can then just use just one field for this system. And so we'll proceed with just one field. And this then is the theory. My bulk action, and it's just the typical, we have a scalar with some potential and gravity involved. And then we have to have a UV brain. And we'll have a potential on that UV brain that will give us something, and I'll specify these later. But right now, you can see that the background solution is a lot more complicated than the two-scalar field case. You have this square root of stuff, and then there's this inverse hyperbolic sine, so it looks pretty nasty, but... you can solve it, and I haven't specified the potentials, but you'll get this as your background solution. All right. But even though it's very complicated, it does actually capture the two scalar field case.
Is there a reason you're being coy about what the potentials are?
Yes.
Tell us what it is. So
sure. The reason why I mean,
come on, you're confident, but not
the reason why I'm not telling you, well, the potential for the two scalar field case, of course, isn't relevant for what I was doing, but it's pretty nasty in and of itself. But this one you can't actually solve analytically, which is one of the problems that they were having with the case for the potential. What you can do is you can parameterize it, and I'll show you what the You can say that this eta field is related to what I call a beta, and then you can give the potential in terms of beta, and then so you have an implicit definition, which is why I'm not telling you what they are at the moment. But we'll discuss them, and then they do simplify in certain limiting cases. So
you can do it with one field. Is it different? That's why it's harder for you.
Well, you can solve the system with one field, but you won't get the power law behavior that you had before. Except, for large z, when z is much, much larger than mu, then if you go back here, you can see that this piece then will basically dominate your expression, and then it just becomes the square root of something squared. So you do reproduce at large z this dilettante behavior, so it does capture that. And then for small z, you can look at it and do the expansion, and you'll see that it looks very much like their tachyon. So you have this function does extrapolate between the two fields. It's capturing that behavior. All right, so now we're here at the potentials, which are also complicated. So we specified the geometry, so we need to get a potential that will solve them. To do that, use the superpotential technique that DeWolf and others gave us that tells us how to relate the bulk potential to this function W, which we'll call the superpotential. Of course, this is inspired by supersymmetry, but it's not required. And then it relates the boundary potential to this function evaluated at the boundary and the derivative of this function evaluated at the boundary. But the nice part of it is that it converts your Einstein equations, which of course were nonlinear equations that are nasty to solve, into a first order system. And if you just make this identification, this looks ugly because we're using the z coordinate. It actually looks simpler in the y coordinate, the physical coordinate. But this is the identification that you do. The derivative of this metric factor is related to the superpotential, and then the derivative of the field is related to a derivative of the superpotential with respect to the field. So if you do that, then this is what I was commenting about before, is we can get the superpotential, but I can't tell you what it is explicitly as a function of eta. What I can do is implicitly define it as a function of eta, where in terms of this beta, which is a function of eta, and then this expression here would define what eta is in terms, well, what beta is function of eta, but I can't tell you. I mean, that's a transcendental equation. I can't solve it. So, on the other hand, if I look at the derivative of eta with respect to beta, it's this, which is always positive. So that means I can make some associations, such as large beta is going to imply just large eta, or large eta will imply large beta. So then if I do an expression for large eta or large beta, then this eta field is dominated by the hyperbolic sine piece, because, you know, that's an exponential, and that will be the part that dominates, which, of course, is then approximately the hyperbolic cosine that you saw in your superpotential here. So then what I can do is give you an asymptotic form at large eta, and it looks like this. It's just eta times e to the eta over the square root of 3. And this comes back, actually, to your comment that, this particular form at large eta is actually relevant because the soft law actually has a curvature singularity in it. It's hard to see if you look at it in the z-coordinate. This is the Ricci scale, the curvature here. And, it's just your ADS piece here, and then the scalar pieces. You can see that if you take z to infinity, that, you know, this blows up and this piece blows up. So it looks like it does go to infinity, but at infinity. So it should be infinitely far away. But if I switch to the y-coordinate and to do the usual definition for the y-coordinate, and you have to perform the integral, it involves these incomplete gamma functions. But you can do it where the metric, the line element now, is given by this. So this is really your physical coordinate. And then if you look just at this y, and since the curvature, the singularity was at infinite z, you can just take the limit as z goes to infinity, and I've just defined it as this quantity ys. And you'll see then that you get this piece here, which is finite. Then you can see that physically your space does have a singularity at a finite distance in it. But that could cause problems, because if I have a singularity, I now have an induced boundary, which implies induced boundary terms, and I might alter my equations of motion, so I could end up adding a constant to my equations of motion, and that would be bad, because if these terms don't vanish, if they give me a constant, then I would get a 4D cosmological constant that was non-zero, which, of course, I can't have, because I was assuming that my 4D space, you know, sliced up along the fifth dimension, was always Minkowski space, was always flat space-time. So I better be careful and check that my theory is self-consistent, that I do have that. And Cabrera et al. Gave us what the self-consistency condition was. And I won't go into the details. It was just this, that the superpotential has to grow asymptotically slower than e to the 2 eta over the square root of 3. And actually, the restriction is on the superpotential, not the potential. If you try to make it on the potential, it's a weaker condition that you can violate. But if you put it on this superpotential, then it's definitely this. And so you can compare the asymptotic form of this superpotential to this. And of course, it does grow slower than that, so we're okay, and we get a nice check mark. Okay.
What's the nature of the singularity? Is it a curvature singularity?
Yeah, it's a curvature singularity at that.
So what does consistency mean? I don't understand. What does this consistency condition come from?
The consistency...
What is it expressing? What is it telling you?
So at the curvature singularity, you could pick up a constant piece is the point. A cosmological constant is basically what. If you evaluate your equations of motion and they're not zero there, right? Your space ended. So then you can evaluate your equations of motion right there. And you can see, is it a constant or is it zero? And it better be zero. And if it's not zero, then you have to add a constant to your equations of motion to make it zero at that point.
What does it mean? Don't the equations of motion give zero when you're just inside the singularity by construction?
No, I think that's the point. They won't always be set. They will always give you zero if you permit a non-zero 4D cosmological constant. But they won't always give you zero if you don't permit a non-zero 4D cosmological constant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. But I don't see what it has to do with the singularity.
So. If there's singularity, usually equations of motion are no longer valid, right? Because the variational principle die off at infinity. You trust your equations of motion. But if you have singularity, you have to put something there, bound reaction.
Right.
And that will affect your field equations. Now you have to redo your field equations. That's what you're saying, right?
Essentially, yes. Yeah.
Just the boundary.
But how can you put a boundary action where there's a curvature singularity?
Why not? There is a boundary where there's a curvature singularity.
The terms of the equation are becoming infinite. I'm not saying it can't be done.
You can cure that. Why? If you put a boundary and some boundary action. Right.
Well, so if there's a problem,
yeah.
Right? So the superpotential that we have doesn't have the problem. It actually self-satisfies those issues. But if you have any, if there is a problem, then yes, you could put like a brain there, and then you would be okay.
How do you know if there's a problem?
That was the self-conditioned system.
How did they
define
a problem?
Why
are you using anti-equation? If your curvature is so big that you're not leaving the derivative expansion, what are the rules?
I guess the way that I was, I don't know if this will the answer, but the way that I was interpreting it as, the curvature singularity introduces a boundary. At least we agree with that. Your space ends, so you have an end of space right there. So there's a boundary in your space. So then if you think about having actually two brains, and you have a particular solution to your field equations with two brains, you might need a potential or something on that brain in order to get that that profile. Okay. So then, but the curvature singularity was, of course, induced. So you can think about it as there's a potential problem. If you don't have that extra brain there in this scenario, but your space ends, you might not be able to satisfy it with the profile that you had, because you would need that boundary potential. So if you can adjust your theory such that you don't need that boundary potential where your space ends, then you'll be okay. Is that making...
I guess, you know, part of the problem not knowing what the action is that it's hard to know what the domain of validity of the approximations are. And so one of the questions would be, so part of the spirit of what you're doing sounds like it's ADS-CFT motivated at some level, right?
Well, that was the... For the soft wall, yes. Yeah.
So then the ADS side of the CFT is some sort of a string theory at some level. That's the thing that's dual to the CFT. And then the thinking would be that your Einstein's equation, there's some low energy limit of that string theory and some supergravity limit or something.
Okay.
And so then since your curvature starts to take off, and you know that you're leaving the domain of validity of that.
Okay.
So something has to break down before you...
I mean, does this curve, this is the position of the where the soft wall behavior turns on, is before the curvature singularity.
Yes.
So I mean, in any case, you could, if you wanted to, you could cut off the space.
You're sticking a boundary before you.
You could stick a boundary. It wouldn't affect any of the behavior as long as the soft wall turns on.
Before. Behavior you're interested in is still in the domain of validity.
Yes, it would be.
I
yes.
Mean, you could stick a yeah. I mean, it's sort of like saying like I just want to focus on the lower modes.
Yeah.
The higher modes are going to be localized way out where these effects would take over.
And then your consistency condition has something to do with that. You've got a boundary before the curvature takes off, and you're asking, does the boundary condition there ruin the flatness of space or something like that?
But you're putting another brain, so there's no real curvature singularity.
I won't put it.
The question is, can you insert that brain consistently? Is that what it really means?
Well, so I won't put another brain there, but... The question really that the Cabrera et al. Were doing was, can you consistently have a solution without actually putting a brain there? That was the question they addressed.
Instead of having a solution in this region where the approximation is probably not good, but also where the curvature is blowing up, and you still
yes.
have some notion of a solution, a measure around the boundary or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
They've sort of extended the... I don't think
any of the behavior phenomena depends on the singularity. So I think
okay.
it's way far into the bulk, and all of the phenomenology is at a much lower scale.
Well, that's also, I mean, in this particular case.
But you were saying it was an important consistency check. Cosmological constant.
Yeah, well, to have the theory to be self-consistent, I needed to have this die off appropriately.
But you could imagine cutting the space off if there was a problem.
If you needed to, yes, you could put a boundary there.
Which wouldn't affect any of the behavior.
That's true, yes.
So.
But the singularity was at Z infinity, you told us.
Yes, but it's at finite Y, which is your physical coordinate.
Oh.
Okay. All right, so I guess I will talk about achieving the hierarchy and then perhaps end after that. All right, but so we need to get mu over k 10 to the minus 16. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what's going to set this? And just consider for the moment, of course, mu sets the scale where the scalar back reaction becomes strong on the metric. If we fix the field value at one location, then we have a definite spot where the back reaction becomes small or large. And so then we can look at the boundary condition on the UV brain, and it will fix this field. So generically, what we'll have is our boundary potential will be this function at some parameter. The derivative of this function at some parameter with eta minus eta naught, and then some mass term, which, I mean, so if you were thinking of this Taylor expansion, this is where I break it as a Taylor expansion, and then this parameter here. And then if you do that, so this parameter, this eta naught, which is a parameter on my boundary here, you'll see that the boundary conditions require that the value of the field be eta naught. So then when I evaluate it at the UV ring. So then this parameter here will fix the field at a particular spot, and then it will set the scale where the back reaction becomes strong. And so you can just look at what the value of the field then is at the UV brain. And of course, it's this nasty mess. But you can see now that it involves these mu over k's. So then I have this parameter a to naught, which is related to mu over k's. And of course, this is on the UV brain. And so I would expect it to be of the UV scale. And well, I factored out an m 5 to the 3 halves. So in the terminology that I'm using here, I would expect it to be of order 1, naturally. And so then my goal would be to make this of order 1, but somehow get this 10 to the minus 16. All right, so I can't really readily invert that to give me mu over k as a function of this a to naught. But what I can do is graph it. So if I fix the weak scale to be 10 to the minus 16, and then just consider my parameters, well, this is a to naught, or the field there, and nu, since that gave me a relationship between them, this is the plot I get. And then you can see that in, this is very interesting colors that are coming up. you can see the plot that for this region here, when I have nu 1.1 or so to 2 or and beyond, that the value of this parameter, this UV parameter, has to be 10 to the minus 16 or so. So really, I would have to insert the hierarchy there by hand, because it's not of order 1, which is what I would expect it to be. Then if I do a sort of more modest proposal, if I take it between about 0.24 and 1.1 or so, then I have things around 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 8 or so. So I can, in some sense, say I've improved the hierarchy problem, since I'm putting in a 10 to the minus 8 number and getting a 10 to the minus 16 number out. But I haven't really solved it. And then if I really want to actually solve this, I need this parameter to be, this parameter then is of order 1, 0.1 to 2.3, when nu is between 0.9 and 0.24. So then this could be conceivably a natural solution. My parameters are all of order 1 in this scenario, and then I get a 10 to the minus 16 as a result.
Can we see that from the original formula? Because it was just, if you go back to your formula, it's just powers, right?
Well, there's the inverse.
It now looks like it vanishes if mu goes to 0, because it's powers and then the sine inverse.
Wait, if which one goes to 0?
If mu were 0, then I would get a and not a 0, looks like.
Yes.
So then you're choosing mu to be like 0.1-ish.
Yes.
And then how do you see that you get such a small power for a and not for mu? Where's the smallness coming in?
Oh, you're trying to see how I get 10 to the minus 16 out of...
Reflects this formula, yeah.
Yes. I'm not sure I can...
Kind of well,
okay, so I guess the idea is that... so let's say this is around a tenth,
okay,
then. So what you're seeing is that this is 10 to the minus 16 divided by 10. That's 10 to the minus 1.6. So then what you really have done is turned this into an order 1 parameter, this into an order 1 parameter, and this an order 1 parameter. So you can see it in the reverse way. Okay. And then you can also ask, how sensitive is this parameter to mu over k, or how sensitive, if I move that, what happens to that? And so then the percent change in this, for a 1% change in the weak scale I have listed here, if nu is around a fourth, a tenth to a fourth or so, which is the natural solution, a 1% change in the weak scale causes a 0.1% change in a to naught, or consequently a 10, the 10%, 1% change here causes a 10% change here. So that's fairly robust. It's not that sensitive. For between 1 and 3, just 1% change, they're the same. And then if nu is much, much bigger than 1, you end up having being very sensitive to the variation. But nu is going to have other consequences. And now I actually give you the potential at least expanded to quadratic order in eta, because I can't give it as an exact solution because it's not possible for me to invert those equations. But then you have this, of course, this is just your constant ADS piece. And then there's this piece, which, of course, is your mass term. And so then the mass of this eta field then depends on k, as you would expect, and nu. But then now we can go to the ADS-CFT correspondence, and we know that the operator dimension is related to the mass of this field. And so if you just, and this is the relationship here, it's 2 plus the square root of 4 plus m squared over k squared. And then if you just stick this in, you'll see that you get 2 plus a half of the absolute value of 4 minus nu. And so if I want nu to be a fraction, wait, what does that?
That's negative.
This mass is negative for small nu, yes. For large nu, it's positive.
So you don't care?
No, it still satisfies the bound. It's not less than minus 4. This is the 5D bulk mass, so. Or it's greater than minus 4, I'm sorry. So it's okay. In fact, I mean, you can see that when I take this to zero, I mean, the mass will then become zero, so I should be okay.
So, sorry, just before you go on, though, if you go back just a couple of slides to the
that?
No, just keep to the equation that you had.
That.
With that, yeah. So the analog of this in the original age-old RS one with maybe added bulk scalar that stabilizes with back reaction and so forth, was something, like, this is what I'm trying to remember, because I think I did it, which is always troubling. But my memory was...
It's worse.
It was something, but I thought it was basically an exponential, right? And the whole point was that I'm able to, I get a 10 to the minus 16 out basically because I'm... That there's really secretly an exponential kicking around from the warp factor. Somehow this has turned into a power law, and that's or not. It's not even a power law. It's something complicated expansion. But is that? Do you understand why it transitions from one to the other in from so-called hard wall to soft wall?
So
you see what I'm getting at? How
you
I understand
get...
that the tuning that I introduce additional tuning when I have a soft wall. That's not, for some ranges of parameters, that's not obvious why.
So I guess, how should I, with the Goldberger-Wise, maybe, and I hope this will try to answer that. What you have is, all right, so let me put it this way. The soft wall is trying to play the role of both the Goldberger-Wise scalar and the IR brain. So then you have, you know, two things that it's trying to do. So then it becomes more, so then you have to, you know, essentially tune your theory a little bit to get the same result that you would if you had an IR brain where you just have that distance, which is one independent parameter, and then the scalar field's profile, which is another one, which then you can balance them and get the thing.
Okay.
There's a region where you can see that it does turn into
mu over k is basically, you know, in the y coordinates, like e to the pi kr, e to the minus pi kr.
True.
Oh, so that's how you went.
Some power.
So, all right, well, so
that's the exponential you're kind of thinking of.
So, the idea is that when nu goes to infinity, you can get back. Well, if nu is really, really large, then you'll see that exponential that you're talking about. And actually, you can see, you can sort of see that right here. Let's just assume mu is less than k. Then as nu goes to infinity, these pieces all become really, really small. And then, of course, this goes to, this cancels. So this is 1. And then, so this then becomes really, really small, and then it goes to infinity. And then, yeah, that. All right. So now, okay, so we had the corresponding operator in the dual theory. So let me just then focus on this for a second. We wanted nu to be between 0 and 1, and so that then confines your operator to between 2 and 5 halves. So, of course, you're left with a fractional dimension in your operator. So we've already got half of what we were considering our unparticles. One was the operator dimension was fraction, and the other one was that it was a continuum of modes. And now let me then just go to, since I am over time here, if you look at then the fluctuations about this metric, where I've just put them up here, you'll get, of course, tensor modes and vector modes. But what I'll just do is I'll just skip right here to these scalar modes, where, of course, you just have the gravity scalar, and then you have the scalar. Well, if it was if the potential goes to infinity, it's your usual kk tower for the eta with its potential zero mode. So I'm just going to skip past these. And then, of course, just like the Goldberger-Wise scalar mixed with the gravity scalar, you're of course going to have this here. And you can do the careful decomposition. You have to treat massless and massive modes separately. And your massive modes dynamical variable then is this, which of course is just your linear combination of your gravity scalar and your eta. And then you end up with two potential massless modes. They actually won't be in the system. One, which is this combination, which you can see is related to that one. And then there's this additional one. All right, and then just for the massive ones, then you can look at, phrase this, of course, as a one-dimensional quantum mechanics problem where you have a Schrodinger potential. It's just the Schrodinger equation. And then that will actually tell you the mass, the behavior, the eigenvalues, where the energy then corresponds to m squared in the Schrodinger equation. And then what you see is that for nu greater than 1, when z goes to infinity, your potential will go to infinity, so you have these quantized spacings, you get your kk tower. For nu is equal to 1, you have your potential goes to a constant. So then if you look at that energy-wise, you go up and you don't see anything, and then as soon as you hit this constant and above, you have a continuum of modes. So that then is unparticles with a mass gap. You don't see any continuous excitations until you get to here, and then when you get to there, you have the continuum. And actually, for the news less than 1, when you actually solved the hierarchy, it goes to 0, so that's a continuum without a mass gap. Okay, and you can check. You won't have any 4D tachyons. And let me just then finish up with this sort of bit here. I'll just show you that there aren't any massless modes, so that equation requires it to be a constant. If you look at this expression, that constant that you got here appears over here, so you can do the integral. You have a constant times some function, but who cares what it is, plus another constant. Your first boundary condition here will tell you that that's 0. And then if you look at this other boundary condition, you'll find, since this extra constant here is 0, they're both proportional to this, and then you'll get this will generically not be 0. There's no reason you would expect it to be. And then so you'll have to take this to be 0. And so then that will imply that there are no massless modes. So then we have a theory here where there aren't any massless modes, but we have the continuum of states, And so we have the unparticle scenario if we want to achieve the hierarchy. But since I am...
This is a continuum of real states.
A continuum of...
Real, honest to God, 4D world, if this was reality.
That's right, a continuum of 4D states. Yes.
And they're all TV-ish?
You mean a TV-ish? I don't understand. It starts at zero.
It's start at zero.
Yeah.
And you get away with that?
You can get away with it as long as they don't have...
That's the next question.
You can get away with it in the same sense that Georgi got away with it. But remember, as Nu goes to zero... No, he did, but only to a certain extent. See, the trick is to not have them couple strongly enough to the standard model. And these are all in the gravitational sector, so they're all going to be suppressed by some sort of gravitational strength coupling.
What if I sum over them in a loop? Don't I get infinity of them?
What
if they run in a loop and there are infinitely many of them and I integrate over them? Don't you run into a problem with this infinitely many modes?
But there's a weighting, because there's a spectral function.
It's like an RS2. Right?
Yeah.
If you take the wall away, there's the same behavior continuum for atoms, and they just don't. In fact, they couple so weakly that
it's a gravitational coupling.
Yeah,
I mean it's
even less than that.
Right. Yes. And U of 8. That's okay. So then we'll just skip. Then wait, that didn't work. Okay. That's not the last slide. So then we'll just skip to the end. And so examined the Planck-Weak hierarchy for the Bethe-Cookhout softball. We found a natural solution for nu less than 1. Of course, nu less than 1 gave us fractional dimensional operators in the dual theory and also a continuum of modes. And so then a natural hierarchy implies that we get unparticles. All right. That is all.